Welcome to Confessions of a CEO / Chair. My name is Carl Swansbury, and I'm delighted today to welcome you all to my podcast. Today, I'm going to be spending some time with Lucy Armstrong. Many of you will know Lucy, but for those who don't, Lucy is a very experienced, very seasoned chair, having spent many years supporting CEOs and boards of a variety of businesses, both public sector, private sector, and non-for-profit. Lucy currently is chair of the Port of Tyne and also recently appointed chair onto the board of Everflow and Earth Active, to name a few. As a consequence, Lucy has a significant amount of experience when it comes to not only helping CEOs scale businesses, but also she specifically has a high level of interest and in turn knowledge in helping perhaps develop CEOs to become more leaders than managers, and in turn to help create more successful, sustainable, profitable, well-run businesses. I think today we're all going to be able to take an awful lot away from our podcast, so I'm really looking forward to spending some time with Lucy. Lucy, first of all, I just wanted to start by thanking you massively for giving up your time today to feature on my Confessions of a NXD / Chair podcast. So first of all, thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much. It's anything for a cup of tea. It's absolutely fine. Indeed. And I'm out of the rain, so it's good.
That's fine.
It's a good use of my time.
Yeah. Well, before we talk a little bit about your more recent business career, it would be brilliant if you wouldn't mind, for the benefit of our viewers, Lucy, if we could just go right back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And perhaps just spend a few minutes talking a little bit about your education, if that's okay.
Yeah. So I'm the child of two teachers. But my father did an awful lot of other things as well before he became a teacher, like a helicopter pilot, a Royal Marine, amongst other things. And I had a pretty conventional school. I liked school. I went to college and read philosophy, politics and economics. Having done science A-levels, I never knew what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And I moved here straight after college, age 20, when I graduated with my first job in 3i. And I chose 3i... as a complete accident. I didn't know at all what I wanted to do. I was actually going for an interview for Unilever, and next to Unilever in the what was called the disappointments committee was a little leaflet about 3i. Didn't know what venture capital was. A friend who actually went into the Foreign Office had gone on a find out about the Citi course. You have to remember this is the Thatcher era, big investment banking, you know, big consultancies. And I really didn't want to go to London. I wanted to go somewhere else. I didn't know where, didn't know what to do. Read this little leaflet about spending time with family businesses, with entrepreneurial businesses. Thought that looked interesting. It was a bit to do with money. That looked interesting. So I rang the local office, which was Reading, and invited myself to go and have a look. Not for a job, just what do you do? Didn't know what venture capital was. They very kindly allowed me to go for a day, went for a day. And at the end of the day, they said, do you want to go for our interview process for a job? And I thought, well, going to finish college soon, better get a job.
That's right, why not?
So why not? And interestingly, at the interview process for 3i, one of the things was a role play, and we were given four bits of paper. We were given a 6 bullet points about a business, hypothetical business. We were given a profit loss account, a balance sheet, and a cash flow. Those last 3 bits of paper were meaningless to me. I'd never seen one before, didn't know what they were, didn't know how to read them. So I had 6 bullet points and we had half an hour prep. And I saw people drawing diagrams, working out valuations. What I now know is valuations and all kinds of stuff. I didn't. I read the 6 bullet points, walked in the room and said, hello, your business sounds really interesting. Tell me about it. And I've spent the last 35 years asking the same question. Your business sounds really interesting. Tell me about it. Indeed. Tell me what makes it tick. So that's sort of how I ended up. A, here in the Northeast, and B, getting into venture capital. And the golden thread through my whole career is being interested in what makes businesses tick. Why do they work? And particularly those kind of Mittelstand, medium-sized businesses where it's still about human relationships, but there's also an element of discipline and structure and professionalism. But it's that messy bit. It's a bit like a disco. It's not a nice, neat Jane Austen dance. It's a bit like a disco. There's lots of energy, a bit chaotic. Lots going on, but there is some structure. There is some sense of purpose. There's an excitement and there's an energy and an enthusiasm. And that, I think, is quite infectious.
You've said a lot there, so I'm going to try and just unpack some of what you've kindly said, Lucy. So obviously when you decided on the subject to study at college, you did that with no appreciation that you may move into private equity slash business. So at that stage, what were you planning or at least intending to perhaps do professionally?
Literally no idea.
Or did you just not know?
No idea. I did A-levels with maths, physics, chemistry and economics. And then I did PPE. I was interested in people.
Okay.
I've always thought people are what make any organisation work, whether it's a business, a sports team, a church, whatever. I had genuinely no idea. None.
Interesting. So I can just picture you now at 3i having this assessment day.
Yeah.
With lots of graduates, presumably, who had studied math and business and economics or similar subjects. I had perhaps more startling knowledge than you.
In my year in 3i, there were about 10 of us who were little raw graduates, baby graduates, and everyone else was a sort of 30-year-old. They'd been an accountant or an engineer.
Yes.
They'd done an MBA. So they were all about, they were nearly all 10 years or so older than us.
Okay, wow.
And there were, I think, it was in the heyday of 3i, so that's 1989 when I joined. I think there were maybe 20, 25 of us in that year. And a week a month, we would go away from our office. So I was here in Newcastle. I was the first graduate they'd had here. I was the first woman they'd had here. And you'd go for a week away for training with your other, with your sort of peer group, your cohorts. We would have like a week of learning how to say no. Because most of your time when you're assessing businesses, whether you're going to invest, you say no.
That's right.
A lot. So learning to say no assertively,
yes,
and respectfully is actually quite an art. And we would go and learn to do that. Learn how to listen. Learn how to ask questions so that people tell you what's going on, so they volunteer, so they prioritize for you. Learn how to use a summary so that they know that you've been listening and that you have heard what they think they told you. All that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of that. And then, yeah, some of that was also learning to read a balance sheet and learning how to structure deals and that kind of thing as well.
And when you ultimately joined 3i, your cohort, as you say, Lucy, was very varied.
Yeah.
People who were very experienced, very wise, qualified accountants to, as you say, young, aspiring, ambitious graduates, but slightly wet behind, said here.
Yeah.
Was that daunting? Did that make you feel anxious? Because I'm just sort of thinking about how I might have felt in that situation.
Yeah. No. There was no point, and I, this is just me, there's no point pretending you've got skills that you haven't got. What you have to do is, A, trust them that they chose you, so they chose you for something, and also use what you have got and be willing to learn things that you haven't.
Yes.
And go and ask for help.
Yes.
So a good example of that is we had some training, which was sort of early doors video training, care of Warwick Business School, I remember, around accounting. And it just didn't work for me. I didn't learn it that way. So I went off to Northumbria University Night School and did a postgraduate diploma in accounting and finance because I wasn't getting it.
There was a gap in your
knowledge. Yeah, and I wasn't satisfied. And the way it was being offered to me through 3i wasn't working for me. So go and find an alternative. But I went and talked to my boss and said, this isn't really working. I'm not really getting it. I've researched. I found this course. I'll do it at night school. And, you know, the deal was I'll go to night school and spend two nights a week doing it. But please, will 3i pay for it? Well, yeah, that works. So, yeah. And it meant later on when I did an MBA, I was exempt some of the exams because I'd done that. So I was quite handy.
That's right. Good news. And obviously, you mentioned that the initial interview with 3i was in Reading.
Yeah.
Could we just talk a little bit about sort of why Newcastle? Because, of course, at that point, 3i was national.
Yeah. 3i had 20-something offices at that time. I said I didn't want to go to London. I didn't want to be in a big city. Most of my cohort from college did go to London or New York or similar. I didn't mind where I went. I said I would prefer to go north, and I was sent here. I'd never stepped foot in Newcastle before.
Really? No friends, no family?
Nothing. No, my extended family are all from Teesside, so I knew Teesside very well. I also knew all of the Northumberland coast because all the way through my childhood, all our holidays were here, but I'd never stepped foot in the city. Right. In the 70s, you didn't take kids to cities.
Of course not.
And if I'd grown up in Teesside, you probably would come here for things like museum and theatre, but because I grew up relatively near London, that all took place in London. So when we were here, I'd been to Beamish since the day it opened, when it was literally one field and one piece of equipment. But yeah, I'd never set foot in Newcastle. Never.
Wow.
And it took me about a week to work out that this was a great place to live and I was going to make my home here.
And obviously you spent many years with 3i. Could we just talk about fundamentally when you left 3i, why you decided at that time to spread your wings, if you will?
I left because I had a boss who was bullying me. And I was profoundly unhappy. I'd worked here, then I had a year-long secondment on a project in London, and then I was due to go to the Birmingham office. And I was looking forward to going there. The guy who ran the office there, I was looking forward to working for him. And I was looking for a house in and around Birmingham, and I found myself looking at the A38 and trying to work out places like Lichfield and so on, and that I would get a house there because then I'd be able to come home at the weekends. And then I found myself saying, what do you mean come home at the weekends? If that means you want to go back to Newcastle every weekend, that means that's your home. So why on earth are you going to go and work in Birmingham? Why are you doing that? You shouldn't. And at the time, as I say, the project where I was always very interesting, I found it very difficult working for the boss I was with, and I felt bullied. And I thought, no, I'm going to leave. So I did. And I didn't have a job at the time, but it was, I am more important than the job. I am more important than making money. And my life as a whole is more important. And that was a sort of reaffirmation of Newcastle is my home and I'm going to be there.
And I appreciate you sharing with me the fact that, you know, you left because you felt bullied and marginalised. Can you just, without going into any detail that you're not comfortable with, can we just talk a little bit about how that bullying came to the fore? Because it can come in so many different forms and shapes, can't it?
I would say it was, as bullies often are, quite an insecure individual. We were a small team. It was quite a high-pressured project. It was a automation computer project that was going across the whole of the organisation. And we were, if you like, the sort of user group.
Right.
A couple of the other people felt the same in the team. I think they handled it differently from me, not any better or worse than me, but just differently from me because they were different personalities. I felt undermined, contradicted, didn't feel that it was constructive challenge, didn't feel that it was constructive support. Life's too short to spend time with people like that. I'm sure other people would have found that person fine to work with, but not me. And clearly in an organisation, it's difficult for other people in senior roles to either undermine someone who's running something or side either way.
Yes.
And this is where often I think processes in organisations around tackling things like bullying, they're quite clumsy mechanisms and nobody comes out a winner. In fact, everybody comes out losing. And I was still quite young. I was in my late 20s. I was single. I didn't really have anything to lose. And I also sort of weighed up that thing that in hindsight, until you leave your first job, you think you have an emotional relationship with your organisation? And of course you don't, because it doesn't have that relationship.
Right.
But you have a whole load of feelings about it. And until you leave it, I don't think you know that. And so with hindsight, I am grateful that I left, precisely because I learnt that. And I learnt that actually inside an organisation, it's the people you work with that you have the relationship with, not it.
Yes.
And I think often when people stay with an organisation for their whole life, they never learn that. They have a different experience, not worse or anything, but it's a different experience and they never learn that.
And how hard was it for you to fundamentally conclude that resigning was the right thing for you? Because of course, to that point, you know, you had a great career.
Yeah.
You were achieving.
Oh, I was asked to stay by a number of senior people. It was hard in the sense of it was emotionally hard. But also, I didn't feel as if I had a choice. I was more important. My well-being, sounding a bit woke here, but that my well-being was more important than the job, because I am bigger than the job, and life's more important than that.
Without doubt. Then, did you feedback when you left the reason for leaving?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And do you think that was dealt with appropriately by the employer?
By the standards of the time, yes.
Yeah, well, that's
would it be handled that way today? No, but by the standards of the time, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, respect. And it wasn't unfair. It wasn't unfair.
Okay, okay. Respect that. Respect that. And of course, you know, Three Eyes' loss was somebody else's gain. So you resigned, for the right principal reason, but with nothing to go to. No. So just talk us through, you know, what then you were looking for from your next role after 3i.
I think you're assuming I've had a plan or I had an idea, and I have never.
An open question.
Yeah, and I have never had a plan. By then, I was able to articulate already by that stage, I seek novelty. I seek change. I like being with other people and influencing and guiding other people. And I have to keep learning. So in that sense, I'm agnostic about where I will go. If it's got those elements, it will be interesting and stimulating for me. What I did learn then, very clearly, which again, growing up in a Thatcher's era in the Southeast, with parents who are teachers, so that not well paid relative to everybody sitting around you, I learned at that point that money actually wasn't a driver for me. Up until then, I'd thought perhaps it was, and it most definitely wasn't.
Mm.
And I know all the literature will tell you that money's a hygiene factor, and once you get to a certain level, it doesn't positively motivate you. Yeah, it didn't do it. Once I'd got to that point, it didn't do anything for me. So it wasn't about money. It's not about status. It is genuinely about whether my brain is being fed, whether I'm learning stuff.
And do you think that ultimately comes from your parents?
Well, DNA clearly has a bit to do with it, and your nurturing as well. Mm. Yes. Mm. I think the nurture nature balance is a really interesting one. So I have a foster brother. So one of my brothers, I have two brothers. One of my brothers is genetically not related to me at all, and yet we all share a very similar sense of humour.
It's interesting, isn't it?
So that can't be genetic, can it? That must be nurture, mustn't it?
Yeah.
Or is it that actually by joining our family, it unlocked in him something that was already there and it was nurtured within our family? Oh. Who knows? So I find the nurture nature thing quite interesting. Certainly, we were absolutely brought up to value education in the broadest sense of the word, not qualifications, not passing exams. I happened to pass exams. My brothers didn't particularly. But to be curious about the world, to be curious.
Continual learning, rather than, as you said, academic qualification, which is very different, isn't it?
And also to be quite Catholic, as in, you can't dismiss something if you haven't tried it.
Yes.
So, you know, give jazz a whirl, give ballet a whirl, go to a football match. Why does someone else enjoy that and you don't enjoy it? So the curiosity bit and being inquisitive, absolutely, we were encouraged to do that. And we were given lots of exposure to things like that so that we could, and we were listened to.
Mm.
So our opinions were sought and were listened to. And our thought processes were interrogated and challenged and encouraged. Definitely all the way, the dining room table was always like that. And interestingly, my best friend at college, she said she had never had a conversation like that until she'd met me. And I said, well, what did you talk about at the tea table then? You know, if you'd listened to the news or you'd had a day at school or you'd been, you know, what did you talk about? And this, well, we didn't talk at the tea table.
Interesting.
And interestingly, one of my godchildren now, when she met her husband's family, the dynamic in her husband's family was very different from the one in her family. And she and I had that conversation about how different families come to different conclusions and do things differently. You think we're all the same, and we're just not. We're just not.
And the nurture point you make is, I think, so important, isn't it? Because I think only then can you materially influence the way your children think, the experiences they have, the things they've been exposed to, because as a parent, that's your responsibility, right?
Yeah, and also listen to how they see the world.
Yes, that's right.
I'm not a parent. I've got lots of godchildren, but I'm not a parent. But watching the world through their eyes and listening to them, they could teach you loads. They're just human beings with slightly less experience of life than you.
That's right.
That's all they are, in my view. You have a responsibility to help guide them and show them bits of the world and expose them to bits of the world. But yeah, listening to their perceptions, really valuable.
I agree. It's funny because our daughter's now 7, Lucy, and genuinely, I love the chit chat over the dinner table.
Yeah.
Because her lack of cynicism,
yeah,
her open mindedness, yeah, is something that I think as you grow older, you lose.
Yeah.
So I love seeing life through her lens.
Yeah.
Because it's a different perspective that she has.
Yeah. I consider some of the best praise I received not that long ago from somebody was when they said I was very childlike. And I said, great, I'm very happy with that.
Yes, that's right. There's two ways you can take that.
I was very happy with that. Because I think if you can stop and stare and wonder and be inquisitive and also be really open, which I think most children are, if they've been nurtured in a positive way, yeah, the world is full of exciting people, things, events. It's amazing.
Something you said indirectly a few times, which I just want to really explore, Lucy. You've talked about really responding positively to environments where there's continual change,
yeah,
almost like dynamism.
Yeah.
And you didn't use that word, but I think that's what you were getting at. Where do you think your hunger or need for continual change comes from?
Yeah, I don't think it's a hunger. There's an energy.
Yes.
I'm quite an energetic person. It's taken me a while to realize I have more energy than quite a lot of people. Yes. So I would say it's rather than hunger, I think it's an appetite, which I think is subtly different. I think hunger is about need, whereas appetite is perhaps more selfish. Perhaps it's wanting more. Yeah, it is. It's sort of feeding my brain both the emotional side of being a human being and the intellectual, and I like both. So I read quite a lot. I read a lot of novels. I don't read business books. I like going to art galleries. I go to quite a lot of music concerts. I enjoy sport. But also I can and do very happily sit and stop and stare and just do nothing. I find it really easy to switch off. Really, really easy.
Certainly with a good book.
Yeah, or nothing. I can literally just sit and stop.
And my brain. Or do you have a process of encouraging yourself to stop?
Don't need to.
No, you can just sit and be at peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how have you managed to do that? Because a lot of people watching this podcast will like the idea of that, but perhaps haven't worked out yet a way of being at peace.
Yeah. I'm afraid I don't have any tricks for that. I just do it.
Yep.
I was on a course once and somebody said, what's your 3 a.m. moment? And I went, what do you mean? They said, well, you know, what do you wake up and worry about at 3 a.m? And I went, well, I don't wake up at 3 a.m. I go to sleep and I wake up in the morning. I don't remember dreams either. I can see that people find things like meditation, going for a walk. I know all the books will tell you. And in fact, I had this conversation again with one of my young godsons as a young adult, and he was sort of concerned about how anxious he might be about going off to university and stuff. And I said, well, what is your routine like? You know, do you get up at the same sort of time? Do you have breakfast? Do you go for a walk? Do you go near running water? Supposed to be very soothing and calming.
Can do.
And so I know those are things that help people. I do those things. I don't have to consciously. I've learnt after the event some of the routines I have. Lockdown was a really good example of that. I really, really enjoyed lockdown. I got up. I went for a walk around Jesmond Dean. So I was in the woods by the water. I'd get back, have my breakfast. You start your day with the teams. I'd stop at lunchtime. You could do all the day jobs, all the running of the house, whereas I used to fit that between sort of 7 p.m. on a Friday and 7 p.m. on a Sunday, whereas all of that you could do simultaneously. I have to confess, we had our hours exercise. There was then I need to go to the shops, but that might be via the town mall.
Right.
So that was another walk to see the cows.
Yep.
and I really enjoyed that. And then listen to a concert in the evening on the radio, read a good book. I enjoyed that. I really did. And I had to force myself. One of the things I did was volunteer at the vaccination centres because I recognised
that
living on my own, I was so enjoying that that I realised, actually, however much I enjoyed it, it was going to come to an end. It probably isn't that healthy to be a hermit constantly.
Yeah. Yes. I think everything in moderation.
And therefore, volunteering at least once a week, it was normally one day a week, meant I was back with people and I was doing something for other people rather than just for myself, and rather than interacting on a screen in real life. So yes, that was very rewarding.
There's something you said a few times, Lucy, which is fascinating, because for a very successful businesswoman, it's clear that from a very early stage, you understood the importance of well-being, of looking after yourself, of investing time in you, whether it be to develop new skills, to do something you enjoy. And I think a lot of people in business sacrifice.
Yeah.
Almost become a victim of their own success of business. Could we just talk a little bit about that? Because you'll see that, I'm sure, often.
Yeah, I often say to people when they're thinking about changing role, and I say, do you want a 10 out of 10 job or do you want a 10 out of 10 life?
Interesting question.
Because I think a 10 out of 10 life doesn't necessarily equate with a 10 out of 10 career or a 10 out of 10 job. Because I don't think the job is everything. So I've never seen it as one or the other. I've always seen I have a life of which part of my life is how I earn money and engage with other people that I get paid for. Part of it is I engage with other people and I don't get paid for it. So I don't compartmentalize a business life and a private life in that sense. I think I've always thought of it as my life.
Yes, right.
Of course, the relationships one has at work are different from the ones one has, which are family ones or friend ones, but it's just a set of relationships that you have. I don't see it as so separate from the rest of my life.
Yes.
Though interestingly, I remember when Chris Brink came as the vice chancellor at Newcastle University here, and Olivia Grant was the chair at the time, and Chris had come to Britain from South Africa, having worked in Australia and South Africa, but never worked in Britain. I think he'd done his PhD here, or one of his PhDs, he had two. She arranged for him to go and have a cup of tea with different people, of which I was one. And I remember we went to the pub and we had a beer. And he said, did I have any advice of moving to Newcastle? And I said, you need to decide whether your home and family life is part of your business life or not. Because in this town, your kids will be at school with people that you work with, and you'll be at the school gate, or you'll be at the Cub Scout or the concert. And so you need to decide. That's a binary decision. Either there either will be or it won't be, and you can't choose one and then, you know, change it.
Yeah.
And he went, right, what did you choose? I said, well, my away from work life is separate from my at work. So people I work with, I may well socialise work wise, but I don't go for dinner parties with them or anything like that. And he went, right, okay. And he said, I think I will do the same. I said, well, all I would say is make the choice and know that you are consciously making that choice, because you can't undo it. I know other people make different choices.
Yeah.
But that's about the only bit where I think that bit of my world doesn't merge with that bit of my world. But I think of it as one.
Mm. And you mentioned there that to have a 10 out of 10 life, it might mean you have a 9 out of 10 career.
Yeah.
Because you can't be excellent in all aspects of everything.
Yeah.
Just to understand a bit more about that, and this probably moves us slightly on to talk a little bit about, I guess, what you have been doing over recent years as chair, NXD, and in fact mentor to individuals. How do you help someone appreciate what their priorities are, accepting you should never sacrifice, or you should never, should you give up your life in pursuit of having a successful business? Because, as you say, your life is more important than anything.
But in my experience, particularly for founders, often the business is their life. It is their most, it goes to my point earlier, until you leave your first employer, you don't realize you're the one that had the emotion, not it. I think often my experience is, let me answer it this way. The fact that a company is a person in law, I think is a very helpful concept. And often I talk to entrepreneurs and founders about that, because I think for many of them, it is the love of their life. And it is the person they love most. And therefore, they won't have the sense of sacrifice that perhaps others see from the outside. I think there's also a huge difference between somebody who might devote their life and, if you like, be a corporate career person and as the Japanese call it, a salary man, they actually have a word for it, which is different again from perhaps a founder or an entrepreneur. I think the emotional connection is different, and therefore the challenge around sacrifice or amount of hours or choices made are very different. I forget the name of the guy, the BP guy, during after the horrible disaster and in the Senate investigation, he, in hindsight, very foolishly said, "I want my life back," because he wanted to be able to go back to doing. And his lack of understanding that the people who were interrogating him and asking him, you know, that was deeply, deeply offensive. But I could also see exactly what he meant, which was, in what way was he responsible for that disaster? What could he have done differently? Why was he answering? Because he was dutifully doing what he was supposed to do as a corporate leader. So I think it's a long-winded way of saying you have to try and stand in the other person's shoes and see the world from their perspective. And where they are struggling with something, your job as, if you're formally the chair or a mentor or just, you know, a professional friend, challenge and support is exactly that, challenge and support. Try and help them see the world from a different perspective from theirs. Try and help them understand why their perspective might be causing them more harm than good. Try and help, and really hard, really, really hard. Somebody's founded something, coming to terms with the idea they might not be now the best person to look after that thing and to enable that thing to be everything it can be may require them to exit. That is an incredibly hard thing for a human being to come to terms with. Again, I draw the analogy with children. I often see entrepreneurs, and normally they're sort of middle-aged men, so you can have this conversation about, you know, your business is now a teenager, so it's choosing some friends of its own. It's going out. It's making some decisions. It's answering back. And the trouble is you're still parenting it by winding it every 4 hours, yes, changing a nappy and putting it down for a sleep. And that's not how you parent a teenager. You have to do it differently. Entrepreneurs, unlike corporate leaders or public sector leaders or anyone in a large organization, you don't have constant feedback. You don't have psychometric tests. You don't have annual appraisals. You don't have a peer group. So you're lonely and alone, very alone. So how do you learn that tomorrow is different from yesterday? Yesterday was stunningly successful. I won an award. I got my villa in Portugal. I got my Mercedes. What do you mean I have to do everything differently? And who are you to tell me it should be different? You've never run anything. You've never built your own business. You're not a millionaire. And who the hell do you think you are telling me I must stop running my business? So they are really difficult ideas to get human beings to think about, and then really difficult conversations to have with them. And you don't have it in one conversation.
No,
and has to be opportunistic.
Yes. So just to move on a little, obviously you left 3i,
yeah,
for the reasons we've discussed, without really any intention or plan as to what may come next.
Yeah. So
could you just talk me through, Lucy, how you decided what did come next for you?
Yeah. So I say the driver was I was going to stay here. And ironically, I ended up working for Courtauld Textiles, and I spent most of my life on an aeroplane traveling the world, actually.
So not in the Northeast.
No, I lived here. I absolutely lived here.
Never here physically.
There was one famous occasion when I was due home on a Friday night and friends were coming round for tea, and I didn't get home until Saturday lunchtime, and they had tea at my house without me. And I got home on Saturday lunchtime, and on Sunday morning, I was leaving for another continent.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was, again, later. It's like, this really isn't the sensible use of your time. But staying here was, this as my home was the thing that was really important. Courtauld Textiles was, well, you've spent all this time with these smallish, medium-sized businesses, but you've never run one. You've never actually had to take responsibility for it. You've sort of swanned in, talked to people, helped them make hopefully slightly better decisions, and then watched them. So what's it like if you actually go and do it? Of course, Courtauld wasn't going to let me go and run anything. So I was the person who came from head office to help you. I spent a lot of time with chief execs. Courtauld was a very devolved business internationally, very different cultures, very different kinds of chief executives of businesses, making stuff, making shirts, T-shirts. We had brands like Pringle. We did a lot of Marks and Spencer's socks, jumpers, underwear, operated all around the world. And it was fascinating, you know, making things, seeing factories running. It was brilliant. But essentially, again, my job was asking questions, helping people work out what a better solution than they were currently doing, thinking it through better, differently, acting as a foil rather than running the sausage machine, making it work every day. I have not line managed people. I haven't been a production director. I haven't been a sales director. I haven't been a chief executive. I've never had direct control of anything. And my experience is that that's one of the challenges. As people and as organizations grow, the leaders have to lead rather than manage. And I think a lot of people struggle to understand the difference between managing and leading. And the more senior you become, the more of a generalist, and you have no control. You have huge influence, but no control. And I think the role of leadership actually is about simplifying things. And it's about focusing on two or three key things, most of which are about behaviors and values. And it's trying to instill that culture. You can influence the culture in the place without, and the port would be a brilliant example. Last night at 2 a.m., some of my colleagues at the port will have made decisions about boarding ships in the middle of the river in weather conditions whilst I was fast asleep. I've got no control over the decision they've made. What I have some influence over is, do we have a culture at the port which says, and that we all believe, which is, I want you to make a safe decision. I want you to prioritize you and others being safe ahead of doing it quickly, making money, upsetting people. Be safe. I am sitting here now. I don't know whether we had any. I had nothing on my phone this morning to say we had any incidents last night, and I do have real-time information. So I know they made safe decisions. So my job, I had no control over that, but I had some ability over some years as the chair of the port to influence a culture that means I'm confident that they will have made safe decisions. And you either relax into understanding that you have no control or you don't. Again, COVID was fascinating. I chaired a group of chairs nationally on behalf of the government, and it was like a self-help group for chairs, and we did it all on Teams, and it was weird. The first thing they all talked about, I was asked to facilitate the group, the first thing they all talked about was having virtual gin and tonics with their fellow non-execs on a Friday evening, and I thought, well, I don't have a gin and tonic with my non-execs in real life, let alone virtually, so that was the first thing. And then the second thing they all talked about was... Well, we've doubled our number of board meetings, and we're meeting weekly, and I'm speaking to my chief exec every day, and we're doing this, this, and this. And I thought, wow, I had done completely the reverse with the various organizations I chair, public, private, and not-for-profit. I'd said to each of my chief execs, my phone will be on 24/7. Normally it isn't. You can call me whenever you need to, and I will answer. I won't call you, because you've got to get on with stuff, dealing with this crisis. But I'm here. Basically, I was saying, I trust you. If you think you need me, then call me. But I'm not going to interfere. But I'm going to support you. I halved the number of board meetings and I halved the length of them, because I didn't think good use of my executive's time was writing papers for anxious non-execs. I thought it was time to dip into the reservoir of trust that you build up over working together for years. And it was time to extract that trust and to trust them. And to, I couldn't make better, worse decisions than my chief exec. There wasn't space for two people to be doing it. So my job was to be a foil, to be a fallback, to be a challenge, to be a support, and trust my chief execs to be mature adults in the hope that I also was a mature adult and that we would add value to one another's different roles, not substitute. So these are the chairs. I think what they were desperately wanting to do was get back in control. And I wondered why I was different. And other than it was just being odd, I concluded it was because I'd not been a chief exec.
I never had
control. I've never had control, so I don't need it.
Yes.
And now, in a crisis, is the worst time to have a rookie controller, it seems to me. Whereas I think they wanted to roll their sleeves back up. And if I was one of their chief execs, I think what I would have felt was, she doesn't trust me.
Mm. And do you think that they wanted to do that because control perhaps equals power, the ability to dictate, things would be done on terms they were comfortable with? Is that why?
I think it was about their own
control.
Yeah, I think often people want control because of their own insecurity of being out of control.
Yes.
And I get that. I understand that. And I like routines because they give you control as well. But that's where, again, I think the role of chair is so different from the role of any executive or the role of a non-exec, which is understanding you never have control, ever. You have responsibility.
Mm.
Legally, of course, you're identical with the executive directors. But you have to accept that. You have to take on the chin that their role is to run it. Yours is to challenge and support. And yeah, you either accept the legal responsibility alongside that and understand that other people are pulling those levers, or you shouldn't be a non-exec. And often, again, it's wonderful, and I am going to be very pejorative here, but middle-aged men who've been very successful in the private sector, and they go, and now I'm going to go and help the country. I'm going to go and chair my local hospital trust, and I'm going to sort the NHS out. And you think, oh, right, okay, great. How marvellous, how lucky the NHS is. And you sort of tentatively say, do you think good people work in the NHS? Oh, yes, marvellous people. You know, some of my best friends are doctors. Great, okay. Do you think, you know, they're motivated to do the right things and they're well-trained? Yes, yes. But it's a mess. Oh, it's a terrible mess. It's awful. Is it possible that something's going on in that organisation that you can't see? If they're good people and they're motivated well, but it's a mess, there's something else going on, isn't there?
Exactly.
They're not cocking up. Something else is happening. Well, what else is happening? Well, the NHS has got public demands, transparency demands, accountability demands. It's got a load of history and culture, and it's a sacred cow of our national psyche. All of that, your business doesn't have to carry any of that. So that's maybe why it's difficult. That's maybe why it's different. That's maybe why it's failing in your eyes, because maybe the task is a very different one. And maybe you can't see that.
And obviously you've mentioned Port of Tyne there.
Yeah.
You chair the board of the Port of Tyne.
Yeah.
And that's a very large business.
Well, we're not actually. Oh. We're 300 people and we're 50 million turnover. Yeah. So we're not very large. We're
well,
not large at
that's
all.
Right. It is a SME business.
Yes.
The truth. But
yeah.
I guess to certain viewers,
yeah.
who have owned a managed business
yeah.
that perhaps they've founded, that they are still MD
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
In relative
yeah.
terms,
yes.
probably a much more sizable
yeah.
Organisation.
Yeah.
So just a question. In terms of a founder,
yeah.
MD,
yeah.
Whom runs his or her business and has complete control,
yeah.
As they look to continue to grow the business and want to empower people,
yeah.
want to create succession, they might be thinking about positioning a business for a transaction.
Yeah.
How do you think they can go about over time allowing control
yeah.
To fall away so they can influence but don't have to be involved in every aspect of everything?
Yeah. My experience is that that is a very hard transition and many people can't do it. Many people don't want to do it. So I think the first thing is, do they want to do
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
And I think they have to take a decision, which is, do they want to see their business be everything it can be, irrespective of what that means for them? And my experience, or the way I describe it, is I think they have to come to that point, if you like, intellectually. And then separately, it's possible to help guide them to come to terms with that emotionally.
Yes.
But I don't think you've got to have both elements. I don't think you can have one and not the other. And my experience is that by talking about it intellectually, and that's why I find it helpful to think about the business as a person, and often people who are parents, you can say, well, you want your child to be everything it can be, And that may mean it's going to fall out with you. It may mean it's going to make choices that you wouldn't make. And if you can get them to intellectually understand it's a not a dissimilar process for the business, I think that starts them on some of the emotional journey. I think also it is a fallacy that they were ever in control.
Mm.
They had all the jobs to do. That doesn't mean they were in control.
Yes.
The Lou role needed changing, so they had to change the Lou role. A really good example of this is my old 3i boss went to run a business in France, and he was talking about the French business culture, and they had an office, and it had lawn, and the grass was growing. And one of his colleagues came in, and David had learned French and was fluent in French, and they said, you know, the lawn's, you know, not been mown. And David went, yeah, I noticed that. And of course, as a Brit, he was thinking, well, I'm the chief exec. Well, I've got nothing to do with, you know, mowing the lawn. But in the French culture, the assumption was, well, so you need to tell someone to go out.
Right, it's all by instruction.
Yeah. So I think people confuse being in control with having to do all the jobs. I think you can start to have a conversation around, you don't sort of knock on the front door and tell someone, by the way, you won't be running this business in 12 months' time. In my experience, that's not a healthy way to go about it. You will be redundant. I've come to share that good news with you. I think you can start to help them see that perhaps the role of employee, the role of director, and the role of shareholder, those roles at the beginning are all fused together. And I think in your own head, you don't know which one you're being. But as a business develops, or any organization develops, those roles start to separate out. And very quickly, often founders drop the role of employee. And they start to have staff who change the Lou role and do the sales and so on. But because they've done all those jobs, they think they can do each of those. The fact those jobs might have changed since they did them, we'll gloss over that bit. But those three roles start to separate. So you can start to have a conversation about, so are you telling me that as a director, or is that you as a shareholder? And I've literally said that. And my job as a chair or a non-exec is to help people think differently, or to be clearer in their thinking, and to be conscious about the decisions they're making. So simply by asking that, and they go, means they're thinking. And they're consciously sort of saying, oh, might there be a difference? Oh, they're two rules? Right, though. And so that's why it takes time. And you have to be opportunistic. You have to be in the room to have the opportunity to say, well, is that about being a shareholder or whatever? And in family businesses, that becomes even more complicated because it's also about being a parent. So you want little Jimmy to become the sales director. Is that because you're his dad? Is that because Jimmy needs a job? Is that because your wife's told you Jimmy is wonderful? Or is that because Jimmy's the right person for the job? And if Jimmy's going to do it, what about Chloe? I remember going to a business in the Midlands, and they talked about eight people in the next generation, three of whom were in the business, and they had plans for the development of the three. And I kept asking them, what are the other five doing? And in the end, they got really annoyed with me. They're like, why are you asking me about the other five? They're not in the business. I said, no, but they might be in 20 years' time. And they might be learning things outside that are much more valuable to your business than the three that you're training inside. And he didn't like me. And he went, oh. I said, that's why I'm asking. Yeah, he didn't like that. I was probably a bit too blunt.
No.
I was too blunt. But asking them to interrogate their own thinking, asking them to interrogate their own motivations, asking them to make conscious decisions rather than subconscious ones. And again, my experience of a lot of entrepreneurs, and I've said this publicly, I remember following Lorna Moran on a stage once where she was talking about being a founder and growing a business. And I came on and I did do it slightly tongue-in-cheek. I said, it's remarkable, isn't it? You know, every elite athlete has a coach. Every, you know, solo musician in the world has a teacher. But somehow entrepreneurs are uniquely gifted and need no training, no development, and can't possibly take advice from anybody. How is that? How is that the one aspect of human endeavor that is given by God divinely?
I've got to ask, how did Lorna
respond? She giggled. I do know Lorna well,
cheek, then.
And she giggled.
Good. But the point remains interesting.
Yes, I think it does. And I think some of it, I don't blame entrepreneurs for this, some of it is culturally, and particularly in Britain, we sort of think it's a mystique. And we sort of think entrepreneurs are magicians in a way that nobody else is. And only when you start to say, well, you know, all our Olympic athletes who've won medals all have teams of coaches.
That's right.
Whole rafts of people. Ali Murray talks constantly about, you know, the nutritionist, the psychologist, the backhand coach. When you take a team sport, you know, the defensive coaches, the kicking coaches, why do we not think that about business? And then, tragically, we have an academic qualification called an MBA. My dad was very clever with words. He used to joke that my mother's BA meant bugger all. Sadly, he didn't live to see me get my MBA, but I'm a master of bugger all. And
he'd be proud.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, MBAs are about looking at business. But business is just a human endeavor. So it's all about psychology. It's all about, I think it would be much more fruitful if we thought about anthropology and symbolism and culture and tribes and so on when we think about business. It's not a rational pursuit, and nor is anything else that human beings do. It's not rational. There are elements of rationality, but it is not a rational pursuit. And the real key often to success, A, is luck. Huge, huge amount of luck. And then often it is the emotional bit. It is that human connection. It's that bit of creativity. It's that bit of risk-taking. It's that bit of being scared. It's the emotional bit that actually makes the difference. Not the business planning, not the spreadsheet. It's the other stuff.
Mm. And the journey that founders, CEOs, executives go on, of course, is varied depending on circumstance, scale of business, experience, etc. Could you just tell me a little bit about how you see the role of chair being different to mentor and coach? Because the role can be perceived as one in the same, but of course, quite different.
Yeah, no, I think they are very different. You know, a chair is a legal director of the company. And twice this has happened to me where I've been asked to take on non-exec or chair role, and I've sat with the chief exec leader of the organization and I said, I will do this. You need to understand I am not your friend and my focus is the organization.
Yes.
And they've gone, yes, yes, yes. And I know that in their head it was like, no, no, no. they just assumed I was coming to be their friend.
Yes.
So I find it very helpful that I take the legal responsibility. So my duty is to the company.
Not the individual.
Not the individual. Absolutely, I must behave with integrity towards individual human beings and treat them decently in pursuit of the needs of the organization. And that is the inherent challenge in leading, that sometimes you have to make decisions that hurt people. I don't mean physically, but that hurt them, or that they would rather you didn't take, because your duty to the organization as a whole trumps that to the individual. But you have to do that properly, and you have to do that with decency. And so being the chair, being the challenge and support rather than the mentor to your chief exec, to your executive team, is part and parcel of that. And it is a fine line to walk. I often say, there are two people in an organization who don't belong to a team. One is the chief exec and one is the chair. They must look and behave like the best team players in the whole organization, and yet neither of them are, because the chief exec can fire any of the executives and the chair can fire the chief exec. The chair and the chief exec together must appear to be a high-functioning team, and yet they are not a team. And that is the dichotomy at the heart of both roles. It's why they are roles which are solitary. And yet, all of your behaviours has to be, and your values have to be about helping others behave as a team, because the team will achieve more than any individual. And that challenge is both an intellectual challenge and is an emotional challenge constantly. That's the bit I find really interesting. Mm. Oh. And so the role of the chair, I think, is to help a chief exec, particularly a new one, or a founder, understand that and be that foil and that conscience and just accept that reality, which is I have to trust somebody and talk to them and share information with them, knowing that they could fire me. But until the moment they fire me, they have to support me. And that is weird. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you stand back from that, that is a weird relationship to be in. Unlike any other relationship you're in life, in my experience. But I think it's really important in order for people to lead. And I go back to my comment earlier about the difference between management and leading. For me, leadership is about helping people go to a place they didn't know they could get to, and that you might not be able to articulate. Whereas management is with a finite set of resources, a finite set of tasks within a box, achieve. That ambiguity about going forward, going where nobody has gone before, that is the ambiguity of leadership. And that's why, for me, leadership is much more about trust and emotion and relationships, because you're going where you don't know. So as the leader, fundamentally, people have got to believe in you. That means they know you, they need to know you. That means you need to know yourself. And that means you need to admit that you've got feet of clay, because they will see your feet of clay. They will see it from a mile off. They always know you, so you better know yourself.
Yeah.
People will follow flawed human beings because they trust them and believe in them. And I think the big mistake that a lot of leaders make, and a lot of, again, founders, is they conflate leadership with perfection and control. And rather than acknowledging it's the emotional bit that allows people to follow, they think they have to be out front and they have to be better than or bigger than or faster than. The other analogy I have is for the Great North Run. You know, a chief exec or a chair is probably an elite runner and they're given the number one by Brendan Foster. They could get to South Shields in an hour and a half. That's not their job. Their job is to make sure the 50,000 get to South Shields in the best race each of those 50,000 can run. So for that means that they actually they run up and down the 50,000 on the Central Motorway and they go, Carl, today is your day. I can see you peaking. And I know you can do it. You know, Fred, pull your socks up. You know, you need to. And actually they end up running up and down in order to enable others to get there.
Oh.
They may never actually go to South Shields themselves, but may make sure the 50,000 do. Mm. That is a very different sense. And it's why I don't particularly like it when people talk about business being like sport. Sport has a winner and a loser. Business doesn't. I don't think life particularly does either. It's a series of stops, it's more like a train journey without an end stop. Well, there is an end stop. It's called death. But there's a whole load of choices about which station you get off at and why and what you might choose to do at those particular stations. And the analogy of sport where you have competition and you have win-loss is where that's where it fails for me, because I don't think business is like that.
Mm. It's interesting to hear your perspective on that, because actually, not only, I'm sure, do you know many people in business who believe that actually win-lose is appropriate in business,
yeah.
But actually I've had many very successful entrepreneurs on my podcast whereby they've actually said success for them is when somebody feels shortchanged post-negotiation, which is quite fascinating. And of course, we're all entitled to have a different perspective on the same, but I would agree, isn't it only brilliant to do business in a way that everybody feels positive as a consequence of the business done?
Yeah, I would say, and if you think that each transaction on the way needs to be a win-lose, I would say you're going to have a very ugly culture in your organisation.
That's right, and a big loss at some point, I suspect.
Because inside your organisation, people will have seen win-lose, and my experience is that human beings don't like win-lose, actually.
No. Well, it doesn't need to be so extreme, does it?
Correct. Occasionally, yes, there are.
Tough conversations, but
yeah,
I agree. And just on the point around, I guess, how you now deploy your time, because time is so precious. Obviously, you chair a number of boards.
Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, the Port of Tyne, just as an example.
Yeah.
Do you also act as mentor to individuals outside of boards that you chair?
Yes, I do, but not in a formal sense. So some people will pick the phone up to me or have a coffee with me and they'll pick my... I always describe it as pick my brains, just as I do for others and have always done so. I just see that as, I don't think of it as formally mentoring.
Helping people out.
But also, I learn.
Yeah.
You know, if someone describes an experience they're going through or something they're wrestling with, and I have to think about it, and I have to commune with them about it and try and stand in there, that's a learning process for me too. I'm being very selfish. I gain from listening to other people's concerns, issues, celebrations, successes, what worked, what didn't. That's how I learn. And again, because you're isolated as the chair, you know, there aren't many courses, go and be a chair. Right. There aren't many self-help groups for chairmen. And the ones that do exist, I don't find particularly helpful. I think often people get very status conscious and are busy doing positioning. I haven't got much time for that. So, having a coffee with someone, learning something about how they approached something, just sharing, how did you deal with that? I'm wrestling with this. I'm not sure about it. I think that's where, again, for me, it's hugely valuable to talk to people in different fields because the issues are the same. I remember I was doing the Common Purpose program donkeys years ago, and that is the point, common purpose. So a fire officer and a policeman and a business person, they're all ultimately managing and sets of resources and the creativity and frustration of human beings. They've got a slightly different objective. It's the same.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same. And you can learn from a policeman about how they deal with a situation, how they communicate. And I used to work in a high security prison. And one of the best examples for me of personal leadership that I still apply today is I was on duty on a Saturday morning and I needed to see a prisoner and I needed to give him some information which potentially he would have been very upset by. And by that, I mean, in a high security prison, that means potentially a very dangerous reaction.
Sure.
I needed to talk to prison officers to tell them that I needed to speak to Bert. So I was going to ruin the morning routine. I needed to speak to Bert, Mr. Foggis, and I needed them to protect me, but I couldn't tell them what I was going to tell him. And I needed them to physically protect me in case he kicked off. And if he was going to be upset, even if he didn't kick off and didn't endanger me, he probably would be upset for the rest of the day. And that would probably ruin and disrupt the running of the wing for that morning. That's a really complicated problem, in my view. Really complicated problem to deal with. So how do you get this group of people to allow you to deliver some news over here that could directly impinge on their day? And I still think about that now when I've got different groups of people that I'm, I need to get somewhere. How do I resolve that? How do I resolve that conflict? You have to think and feel hard.
You do.
And something like
that is the greatest example of a situation where without influence, you have nothing.
Correct.
Because you can control those stakeholders because you weren't directly managing them.
Correct.
But you did need them to do what you needed them to do.
Correct.
And that is influence by definition.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, isn't it, when you observe individuals, whether it be in business or outside of business, actually, because they want certain things to happen. They try and give commands or they try and directly issue instruction. And they're not getting the response they want.
Yep.
And they're surprised.
Yeah.
Which in itself surprises me.
Yeah.
Because of course people don't do what they are told without logic, reason, and without appreciating why they will benefit.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that is influence, isn't it?
And you know, toddlers have tantrums because they're frustrated about their inability to communicate their needs, their wants. They're unable to appreciate how they've got to negotiate and navigate an agreed space with the adult that's looking after them or whatever task is ahead. As we get older, that's still in us. We still want to do what we want to do.
That's right.
I don't think that goes anywhere.
It'll be worse than something. But
we finesse how we present it, but it's still deep inside us. I mean, just the standard jokes of couples about, you know, like we're going here. I'm not in the slightest bit interested in this, but it's what we're doing because it's what he, she. And the difference, of course, is in a marriage or in a family or in a friendship, there's that emotional bond and there's that love and there's that cherishing. you don't have that strength of emotion in a workplace, but you've still got to have some kind of emotional attachment. Otherwise, I don't think many people will do many things. They've got to believe some way, shape, or form.
And this goes back to something you mentioned earlier, which is values of a organization and the culture within, because as you said, there's no legal bond like marriage, and there's no sort of intimate love which exists in marriage, but what you do need is a duty of care, and without that, what do you have?
And some of that is tough. You know, this is not holding hands and singing Kumbaya. So, people who work with
me... I'm disappointed, Lucy.
people who work with me will tell you that, you know, I can and will be quite tough. But it does have to come from a place of... And again, it's why I find it helpful to go back. What is the organisation here to do? Is what we're choosing to do helping to achieve that? Is it doing it in a way that minimises any harm or distress to other people? Yes, then we do it then, don't we? Yes. And that, I'm afraid, sometimes includes things like moving people out of roles or redundancy programs or cutting expenditure or whatever. It has to sometimes include those things.
I'm conscious of our time together, Lucy, today. The conversation has been fascinating and there's so much more that I'd love to discuss. But sadly, time is not on our side. I do, however, have two final questions that I'd love your sort of instinctive, immediate response.
Oh, right. Yeah. Favourite pop group? No?
I'll keep that for later, okay. But I am still fascinated to know. The penultimate question that I'd love to ask is, clearly, you know, you are a very successful woman in business, and you are very focused, headstrong, clear, in the way in which you present yourself. My question is, have you ever, to this point in your career, found yourself dealing with any CEO, if you've been checked, who fundamentally has been sexist? Because a lot of our viewers may be females in business, and they might find that that is one of the obstacles that they are having to face. Just wondered if you've had to deal with that yourself, Lucy, to this point.
The most difficult people I've had to deal with are other women, actually.
Okay, interesting. There you are.
Yep, I've found. So, no, I haven't. And I think that is about my own personality, but I have seen it happen to others. And I remember the very famous experiment, which was, it wouldn't be allowed today, a teacher in America split the class and crudely punished the brown-eyed children, and the blue-eyed children were treated better and they had to draw pictures of how they felt. Years later, she carried on, I forget her name, she carried on talking about this, and she was giving a talk to a group of adults, and she was talking about high-pitched female voices. It was America, and it was names like Babs and Pammy and girly-type names, Barbie-type names, and that those women would not be taken seriously. And I remember watching that and thinking, I have never been that kind of woman. I physically am not that kind of woman, and that's not, and I don't have that kind of name, and my voice isn't like that. But I can see that that is that, and I have seen that be a challenge for women who are, if you like, more stereotypically feminine than me.
Right.
I think that is changing. I see it changing a lot. And I think that's broadly because, and I was very lucky, but my generation and onwards, my father wanted his three children to be everything they could be. One of them happened to be a female child.
Yes.
Because my brothers saw that, as fathers, they're bringing their boys and girls up to be everything they can be.
That's right.
So if we're patient, and we do have to be patient sometimes, that is changing.
Yeah.
Is it done and dusted? Absolutely not. If you're well-educated and in a senior role, I think it is far less of an issue than it was, say, for my mother's generation.
Yes.
I think if you're on the checkout in Tesco, maybe not so much. We've got a long way to go.
I appreciate you sharing that insight. And then my final question is, we talked earlier a little bit about sort of the difference between a chair or an NXD and a coach or a mentor.
Yeah.
How important do you think it is for a CEO who is running and building a business to actually have a mentor or a coach outside of the boardroom, helping them evolve as an individual?
Yeah, I think it's a really personal decision. I think some people are very good at picking up a bit of learning over there and a bit over there and synthesizing it for themselves. And therefore, they might be a bit more eclectic, a bit more like a magpie. Sure. Yeah. Some people really benefit from the structure of having a coach.
Yes.
I've worked with some chief execs for whom we've talked about them having a coach and they've chosen to and they found it really helpful. I've worked with some chief execs where we've talked about it and we've concluded it wouldn't be helpful. I think it's really personal. What I have also seen occasionally is people using a coach or multiple coaches as a crutch and an excuse for not taking responsibility. Human beings will gain things.
Yeah.
All human beings will gain things a bit. So again, part of the job of the chair is, are we doing this for the right reason? Are we doing this in order that you perform better in your role, in order that the business thrives, yes, and the organization thrives? If you go down that argument line and you come to the conclusion, yes, absolutely. But as you go down there, if the answer to that question is no, why are we doing it?
And sorry, this is my last question. And do you have a person or persons that you go to for guidance, for direction, for reassurance, for challenge? Do you have a mentor?
I don't have a single one. I am a magpie. I will ask questions of and go to a number of different people, none of whom would be recognized as bigger, uglier versions of me. I think it's often helpful actually to ask a child. If you're wrestling with something, actually ask a child.
Lucy, it's been brilliant to spend some time with you. Huge thanks for your insights, for your humor, for your thought-provoking perspective on a number of matters which are going to be hugely additive to our viewers. So I genuinely would like to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And it's been lovely to catch up with you.
Yeah, no, I've really enjoyed it. It's really good. It's lovely talking about yourself, isn't it?
On that note, thanks, Lucy.
Thank you very much.
It's been a huge pleasure spending some time today with Lucy Armstrong on our Confessions of a CEO / Chair podcast. For me, the key takeaways are, you don't necessarily have to have walked the walk to be able to advise and in turn influence people in business, as long as you understand actually how to influence others. I think for me, the other thing that Lucy evidently was able to share with me today is her absolute commitment to helping not only develop CEOs so they can in turn build more successful, profitable, and sustainable businesses, but actually her real keenness to make sure that business is fair, people are treated appropriately, and actually accepting that in business, win-win is a possible outcome. It's quite clear that Lucy has a huge amount of emotional intelligence and spends a lot of time trying to understand people, accepting people equals business. And I think the one thing that I personally actually have thoroughly enjoyed today is understanding a little bit more about what motivates Lucy as an individual, because she spends all of her life now chairing boards, helping develop other people's businesses and in turn other people. So it's been fascinating to understand how Lucy feels she benefits from the conversations, the interactions, the learning opportunities she is given from the CEOs that she chairs. It's been a pleasure spending time with Lucy today, so I would like to thank Lucy again for her time and for sharing with us her hindsight experience and wisdom. If you've enjoyed this podcast, of course, you can download it from wherever you get your podcast from. Similarly, we have an audio version if you would like to download that to listen to this podcast on the move. But for now, my name is Carl Swansbury. You've been watching Confessions of a CEO / Chair, powered by RG, and we look forward to seeing you in the future on other RG podcasts.